You're listening to KUOW in Seattle. I'm Bill Radke. You've seen the tents, the garbage, the visible parts of Seattle's homelessness crisis. That's a fraction of the problem. Thousands more people are living in and out of shelters, their cars, temporary housing, a friend's couch. Even if you have a job, you're in a city where a one-bedroom apartment rents for almost $2,000 a month. Homelessness might be close behind. What to do about it? Well, the city wants to double what it spends on homeless services by raising property taxes, a $275 million levy that Seattle voters will probably decide on this summer. This is a big decision, and we're going to help you through it over the next 20 minutes or so with my next two guests. First of all, Harvey Lever says you should vote no on this levy. Harley, you've said the city is too wasteful with the money that it's spending now. What could the city do better?
Primarily, what the city needs to do is have robust data capture. If we look at Boston, Houston, Salt Lake City, which have been successful in reducing homelessness, one of the first things that they do is capture a robust amount of data. They want to understand who their homeless neighbors are. They want to understand the strategies that are being used. They want to understand the results of those strategies. And then that information helps inform investments. And we know who the providers are that are doing a really good job. And we know who the providers are that are not doing a really good job. Right now, Seattle has 128 providers running 354 distinct programs. This is a very difficult bureaucracy to manage. And because of this, we have lack of uniform data capture. We're not measuring the outcomes of our strategies, and it leaves us with a tremendous bill. In comparison, Boston has they invest $20 million a year, and they have only 139 unsheltered people living outside. They use data capture and measuring the metrics constantly to inform how best to invest this strategy. Seattle is going to spend over $100 million this year. We have $60 million in homeless services alone. We're going to spend $29 million of the housing levy that we approved last summer. The city council took out a $29 million bond, and we have to pay $27 million in interest on that. So the Seattle voters have done a great job. They've made the investments. We just need to start using our money and our strategies more intelligently.
Okay, a lot of bureaucracy, not enough data. Let's get a response to that. Here in support of Seattle's homelessness tax on property owners, from the Downtown Emergency Service Center, Daniel Malone. Welcome, Daniel.
Thank you, Bill.
Didn't the mayor essentially agree with Harley when Ed Murray said the city is not measuring outcomes enough and was unintentionally, with good intentions, misspending some of its money?
The mayor did announce a plan to reform the system of services to homeless people. That plan is being enacted by the city in various ways. I think what we need to turn our attention to, however, is when this problem ballooned into the current state that it's in. And that has tracked very closely with the dramatic rise in rents that you already mentioned here, Bill. Effectively, rents have gone up in this town double in something like a 5 or 6 year period. That has followed closely a booming economy and significant population growth. In the early part of the recession, our overall homeless number in Seattle was flat for a period of years. We still had population growth happening there, but we were doing a reasonable job in keeping ahead of the growth of homelessness to go along with population growth overall. That has changed since 2013, when the rents really started to skyrocket here. So more pressure on the rental market prices has resulted in more people falling into homelessness, and fewer of those people have been able to exit homelessness as they would have been able to do, 5+ years ago when they experienced a housing crisis. That's how sort of equilibrium used to exist in this system, is people were largely falling in and getting out on their own after relatively short periods of time. That's all changed in the current rental market here, and that's the thing that we have to focus on the most.
So you're saying more efficiency is not going to cover the homelessness crisis?
is not going to cover it. Now, there's room for more efficiency. I have remarked publicly that we largely have, rather than a clear, cohesive system, we largely have a collection of programs. I assume, you know, that's largely in keeping with Harley's view on this, but we are, that's changing. The countywide system called All Home has worked out a new version of coordination for these programs to assign people to the right intervention that works for them. We just don't have enough for everybody here. And this measure is about creating more housing opportunities for people to get them off the streets. That's exactly what we need to be doing.
This levy would pay for rent subsidies, expanding local shelters, mental health and substance abuse treatment. Harley Lever, what's wrong with that? Are you saying that is it just a matter of inefficiency, or is there something about the city's whole approach to this homelessness problem that you don't like?
Well, there are multiple issues. First, if you go to page 44 in Focus Strategies, the Focus Strategies report, it says clearly that
this is from a consultant that the city hired?
Exactly right. It says clearly we actually have enough housing right now in our stock to house all the 3,000 unsheltered homeless neighbors and family members. The issue becomes is we don't use our housing efficiently. And the main driver of this is our use of rapid rehousing.
You'll need to explain. There's so many terms, sure, buzzwords around the homelessness services. What do you mean by rapid rehousing is where the city wants to go, to move toward?
Exactly. And rapid rehousing is what other cities have used, Boston, Houston, Salt Lake City. What it does is it helps supplement rent. It subsidizes rent for people that are either about to face homelessness or they've been in transitional housing. We have an opportunity to get them into housing.
In the private market?
Exactly right. The problem is the Seattle landlords have been maligned by the city council, by the mayor. We have a very anti-landlord, anti-Airbnb relationship. And unfortunately, landlord engagement is one of the five pillars of the Housing First strategy. We need to leverage the private market. And unfortunately, we've created such an environment that most of the landlords are either saying, I don't want to work with the city, or they're selling their units and moving elsewhere.
Daniel, what do you say to Harley's claim that there is, and he's quoting this consultant, that there is currently enough housing stock to house people, we're just not letting the free market do its thing with voucher help?
Well, we don't have enough vouchers to get people into that housing. That's just a clear reality of the situation. The city's consultant that they hired was Barbara Poppy. She made her report based on some of the information that Harley is reading. She said recently that they were working on 2014 data when they were coming up with their recommendations to the city. And she has also talked about this current spending proposal for the levy we're promoting as being in line with her recommendations. This proposal is all about creating resources to get people into housing. A lot of that's going to be in the private market, and landlords need to be recruited to the effort to do that. Some of that housing, however, needs to be in the nonprofit market or in some other way to allow it to be affordable to people long term. Rapid rehousing is a concept that is about short-term rental assistance that is certainly appropriate to a segment of the homeless population. It assumes, however, that people are going to be able to pick up the full cost of the rent on their own. I operate an organization that is actually largely responsible for the Housing First movement in the United States coming about, thanks to some of the evidence that has been produced from the programs we've operated.
Housing First mean relatively low barrier, right? You don't have to get sober and have a job and jump through a bunch of hoops to get into under a roof.
Yeah, exactly. And then things improve from there, instead of the old way of thinking, which was the other way around, that people need to be fixed before they're eligible to be housed. So anyway, I guess the point I'm trying to make is that we're a pioneer in the Housing First movement, and we know what it's like to get people housed who people thought weren't possible to be housed. So it's not for lack of interest or willingness to try to move people through to housing. I've got shelters filled with people that you could stick your head in the door and anybody could and recognize, oh my goodness, these are disabled folks. These are people who are living on fixed incomes. Rapid rehousing is not going to be the trick for those people, because when they have a disability income of $800 a month, they can't afford the rent of $1,900 a month. They're going to have long-term subsidized housing to be able to make it. We don't have enough of that to be able to get them out and into.
Daniel, we've been referring to this consultant, this Ohio-based consultant, Barbara Poppe. One place she departs from the city, criticizes the city, is for what she calls its tolerance of homeless encampments. There are children in these places, and the city lets it happen. If this property tax levy that we're talking about passed, are you saying that would provide so many more housing opportunities that the city would be able to be then zero tolerance on homeless encampments?
I think we need to be clear when we're talking about homeless encampments. There are really two kinds. There are the organized tent encampments that are authorized, essentially.
Right.
And Barbara Poppe has clearly objected to the city spending resources on authorizing and placing these kinds of encampments in different places.
Right.
The city's argument is that, look, just out of basic safety and compassion, we have to do something immediately. We don't want people living in places like this, but we need to do something that's better than the alternative. The other kinds of tent encampment or encampments generally are these organic things that pop up everywhere. I suspect that the things most people in Seattle are familiar seeing are these unorganized, unauthorized encampments that are often accompanied by, you know, large quantities of garbage. And
are those going away if the city spends enough money, if voters approve enough tax money?
Yeah, exactly. When we house people, we're going to not have people having to live in squalor like that. People don't want to live in situations like that. People want to live inside.
Harley, do you accept that? With more money, there's more places for these people to go, and you don't have the authorized or unauthorized encampments.
I don't accept it for two reasons. Primarily is we have a broken system, and we're about to add, they want to add $275 million to a broken system. They've had the opportunity.
But how do you know they're not fixing the system? I mean, we've been taught this has been a declared crisis for more than a year.
Well, you can look at their data. I mean, you're absolutely right.
And they're rebidding these contracts, as you know.
Sure, but they have not changing their metrics. If you go to All Home KC today and you look at the minimum performance standards of all their housing, only 11 out of the 352 listed are meeting their minimum metrics. The other issue we aren't talking about, and I think it's really important, is
that's not true.
We have 80. I have the printout.
You said meeting the minimum metrics, only 11 out of 300 programs meeting it. That's just simply not.
You can go to our Safe Seattle Facebook page. We've posted it this morning. We'll look at that.
We'll send folks to your websites. Sure. That's an easier place for them to parse through these kinds of
information
and disagreements.
But the other most important point is, you know, we have 80,000 seniors over 65 years old. They are being taxed out of their houses. I live with two elderly people in my building, and they're begging me not to raise HOA dues. They are at their limits. Now we have ST3, which is passing. This may stop their mobility as far as getting around town. We have a Trump administration that may just gut a lot of the elderly support. So we have to find balance in here. And so,
what's your idea? What's your better solution than a property tax increase?
Yes. So my better solution is, let's fix the homeless services. Let's follow all the guidelines that Poppe has laid out, that Focus Strategies has laid out, but also let's emulate what Boston, Houston, and Salt Lake City are doing. We keep on going to San Francisco and Portland and Vancouver, all of whom have had failed homeless strategies. We need to start adopting the strategies that have proven to work. Rapid rehousing is a key strategy, but we're destroying a very important relationship with the landlords and the Airbnb that we could leverage to get some of the people that don't require these services out of housing, and then concentrate those services on housing. So
Harley Lever is with the group Safe Seattle, opposing the $275 million property tax levy for homelessness services. Daniel Malone supports the levy. He's with the Downtown Emergency Services Center. And, you know, there's this idea that if Seattle is too generous to homeless people, this free-addle idea, Daniel, do you think helping homeless people attracts more people who want to or are willing to be homelessness so that homelessness never ends here and homelessness spending never ends. Do you buy that free Adel idea?
No, I don't.
Why not? Clearly
there are anecdotes that people use to support it, but when there is actual research done to examine where people were when they became homeless and what people's situations are, it does not support that as a concept, essentially the concept that people are moving here in order to be homeless. People are moving here for opportunity, for sure. Harley and I introduced one another out in the lobby and both realized neither one of us was born and raised here. We both came here for the opportunities that this place presents to lots of people. A majority of the people who live in this area came from somewhere else. People at the bottom of the economic ladder have been squeezed out from housing opportunity in this hot economy and rising rents, and that has ballooned our homelessness numbers in this community. And so we have a responsibility to try to make life better for our fellow citizens who are out there, and this is a compassionate way to go about doing that.
So what about this? So this idea, this notion of people who are already homeless coming here because their friend said, hey, Seattle will help you out, or Seattle will let you camp, or Seattle will get you into a shelter.
Well, again,
it doesn't happen or not significantly?
I don't think it's significant at all. I'm sure you could find somebody to tell you that's what has happened, that they were already homeless when they moved here expecting some kind of opportunity. One would think, however, that once they got here and realized, oh, this means I have to live in squalor in a tent because the shelters are full and there's no chance I'm going to get housing anytime soon, that they would do what they did when coming here and go somewhere else where the opportunities apparently are better for them. So, you know, I don't buy it that it's a real phenomenon that is truly contributing to the depth of the crisis here. And even if it were, I suppose, well, then we have to ask ourselves, you know, so what? In practical terms, what does that mean for us? What are we going to do? Start having some kind of citizenship test to determine who it is we're going to help or not. I think the focus we have to have is making sure that the prosperity that we have in our community extends up and down the economic ladder and doesn't get stuck at some point.
You know, I'll tell you, this homelessness issue has some Seattle progressives really frustrated. Well-meaning liberals have told me in loud voices, I'm compassionate. I have voted to raise my taxes over and over, and it's like if I complain about tents or garbage or crime, I'm a bad guy. Harley, are you a frustrated, misunderstood liberal in this town?
Yeah, I'm a Bernie Sanders supporter. I've fathered the daughter of two lesbian friends of mine. I'm an environmentalist. And the second you try to have a conversation about this, you're labeled as NIMBY. You're labeled as not compassionate. I am absolutely compassionate, but in the same breath, I'm also a data-driven, evidence-based guy. You know, we live in a city that has created enormous organizations built on leveraging data, understanding data, building you know, really good infrastructure, and here we are. And the real frustration is this doesn't have to happen because Boston solved this issue, not solved it, but they reduced it greatly. Houston has done this. We're just taking the wrong approach over and over, and okay. So this is frustrating for all of us.
Daniel, what do you say to a Seattle progressive who feels, you could say frustrated, you could say guilty, that they're being accused of being heartless for saying, what about long-time, law-abiding, overtaxed property owners?
Well, I'm not going to accept that I'm the person who's accusing people of these kinds of things. We've been talking for more than a minute, and I haven't accused Harley.
That's right.
Or anyone else of any.
Yeah,
of,
not
any of those
saying
kinds
that you're
things.
You're making that.
I endorse.
It's a feeling. People have reported
the feeling that people are frustrated.
Yeah.
Shouldn't we all be frustrated and, dare I say, ashamed that this is going on in our community? That we allow ourselves in this time of prosperity to have that kind of destitution among us all. It's just our understanding of the nature of the problem seems to be where we diverge here. And, you know, we can get into these issues around other cities that are supposedly doing a better job. There are plenty of statistics you can look at, including things like the portion of housing units in a community, the portion of need met for people with extreme low incomes in a community. Seattle is near the bottom of that list. Cities like Boston and the Northeast in general are much higher on that list. So are cities in low-cost areas. It's not because those cities in low-cost areas are, you know, doing more with their tax dollars on those things, but it's just naturally cheaper in those places. And Houston has a 7% vacancy rate compared to our 2.7%.
Harley, this is where we pause it, because this is our 20 minutes. Mm-hmm. And as I said, I want to send listeners to a place where they can get more information, look at different claims and studies and numbers and figure out what to think. What's a website I should send people to, Harley Lee?
If you should go to Facebook /SafeSeattle.org .org, we have a conversation there. We have all the information laid out. And I would just say real quick, Boston has the same affordability issues as Seattle.
Daniel Malone, Downtown Emergency Services Center, where should we send listeners who want to know more?
All Home KC is something Harley mentioned. AllHomeKC.org is the convening body trying to address homelessness in a coherent fashion in the community, and they've got a lot of data on their website.
This $275 million property tax levy for homelessness services, it would go for rent subsidies, expanded shelters, mental health, substance abuse treatment, and it's probably going to be on, if you're in Seattle, on your summer ballot. We'll talk more. To both of you. I want to thank you both for helping us think through this big decision. Thanks a lot.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Okay, thank you.
It's The Record, KUOW 94.9 Seattle. Back in a moment. A visitor to Seattle might be moved to take home a native-themed souvenir. In this city named for an Indian chief, we've got T-shirts, carved wooden masks, and so much in between. The market for native-themed goods is huge. But a lot of local Native Americans believe consumers need to understand what they're buying. KUOW's arts and culture reporter Marcy Silman has more.
Let me show you the picture of the pole.
Catherine Bunmark-Hughes scrolls through the photos on her computer.
So here's the pole in Stanley Park that was made by Charlie James, who was a Kwakwaka'wakw artist in the early 20th century.
This totem pole features a thunderbird extending its white, black, and red wings. Bunmark-Hughes pulls up a second picture. It's of a woman in skin-tight clothes that look almost exactly like the thunderbird. She even has fabric wings that dangle from her arms. It's athletic gear designed by Adidas.
It's so incredibly inappropriate that you've taken this pole, which represents chiefly prerogatives and markers of land and heritage and community, and you've made it this tracksuit.
Bunmark-Hughes is curator of Native American art at the University of Washington's Burke Museum. She says this tracksuit's just one of the more visible examples of non-Native appropriation of Native design. You see it everywhere, from ceramic mugs in souvenir shops to clothing in big department stores.
And when I go to the mall and I see something with Northwest Native art on it, it's so familiar to me. It's almost like seeing a family photo on that product.
Seattle artist and entrepreneur Louis Gong spent most of his childhood with his family on the Nooksack Reservation near Bellingham. His Pike Place Market store, Eighth Generation, only sells work created by Native American artisans. Everything from sneakers or skateboards adorned with Native designs to high-end furniture and fine art. Gong's not completely opposed to non-Natives who adapt Native themes.
I think there's a healthy way to be inspired by Native art and Native themes, but those healthy ways don't include Googling Native art, finding something that you like, changing the colors, and throwing it on a product, and thinking it's okay because it's legal.
The 1990 Indian Arts and Crafts Act says you can't market non-Native made art as authentic Native American, but it doesn't say anything about non-Natives who adapt Native design. In this country, intellectual property laws don't explicitly cover traditional Native cultural expression, like totem poles. Catherine Bunmark-Hughes of the Burke Museum.
The notion of copyright comes out of a very Western framework of intellectual property, that it is the creation of a single individual. And we do not have in U.S. copyright law the ability to copyright something that comes out of a communal setting.
Like a totem pole, a chieftain's feathered headdress, or imagery that dates back centuries in tribal history.
You have the legal issue of who made it, are they a recognized artist from a Native American tribe or Alaska Native? But there's the other much more murky world of cultural appropriation and all of the things that get sold with Northwest Coast style designs that may or may not be made by Native artists.
I think cultural appropriation is when people take from a culture and look to benefit from it financially.
Artist Louis Gong estimates the annual market for Native-themed goods in this country is hundreds of millions of dollars when you factor in big companies like Adidas. The federal government's General Accounting Office says it's impossible to give a precise figure. No national database tracks Indian arts and crafts sales. Gong wants consumers to think about how and where they spend their dollars on Native-themed goods. Burke Museum curator Catherine Bunn-Marcus agrees.
We all think about this all the time with so many things we buy. How is it that we can be an ethical consumer these days? And I think that applies to both the food that you buy and the artwork that you bring into your home.
In Seattle, I'm Marcy Silman, KUOW News.
You'll find photos and you'll read more about Seattle artist and entrepreneur Louis Gong at our website, KUOW.org. That's the sound of a grown Galapagos penguin. A grown penguin asking its dad for food. The person who recorded this, University of Washington biology professor Dee Boersma, was amazed that penguins who'd already left the nest and were out foraging on their own would come back to their parents when food was scarce, like a penguin version of Boomerang Kids. When Professor Boersma saw this, she wondered if she had found the answer to a question she's been asking for 45 years.
How is it that they can still survive in the Galapagos? And it took me 45 years to find out, but now I've seen it 5 times, and we just published this piece in the Wilson Bulletin to say that Galapagos penguins feed their young after they leave the nest.
And this is a new thing.
This is a new thing. It's never for penguins, this is the second penguin, and I doubt there will be any other penguins that it's discovered for, because you need to be able to stay at home. Now, people, of course, know, why do you feed your kids after they've left the house? Mm-hmm. We all know it's because you want them to get jobs and be able to stay away from the house and survive. And Galapagos penguins are not that different. What they're doing is feeding their chicks after they've fledged and become juveniles so that they have a better chance of learning how to forage successfully and surviving.
I'm so used to feeling like there's nothing we don't know, nothing we haven't studied, and we're just learning about this from the Galapagos penguins?
I think that that's everybody's sense, that we know so much. But just let me say that it's really important. Science underlines everything, I think, and those that don't believe it should go to Flint and drink the drinking water there. You need EPA checking your drinking water to know if you can drink it. And we want to know more about the natural world, so if we're out looking at the natural world, we'll discover all kinds of interesting things. And I see this as extremely interesting because it shows why Galapagos penguins can still exist on the equator in a very predictable, unpredictable environment.
So I'll ask a very human-centered question. It's interesting, but why should I, a human, care how the Galapagos penguins survive?
Because your life is going to be enriched by the other species that we share the planet with. And the less we know about these other species, the more we're going to lose them. And I think everybody's life is enriched by other creatures, wild places, and learning what's happening. And unfortunately, from my viewpoint, we're becoming so human-centric that we lose the wonder of the natural world. And that's one of the reasons why we have the Center for Ecosystem Sentinels. So, like the canary in the coal mine that tells us you can't breathe the air, penguins are telling us that climate change is real, but they've made incredible adaptions to maintain their resiliency to be able to live in this warming time with less food. Not as well. There's half as many Galapagos penguins probably now as in 1970. So that doesn't bode so well for them, but they've still managed to struggle along, and I think they will continue to if we continue to give them a chance.
Should this make me feel more sanguine about climate change? Because here's an example of a critter adapting and doing kind of okay?
No, I don't think you should be sanguine about climate change at all. I mean, I think these are real problems for humans as well as for wildlife. some organisms are going to be better adept than other ones. Those of us that are humans and are richer can probably do better in a changing environment. But those that are poor, they're going to need some help. And normally they get that help from their relatives or from the government. We believe in those safety nets. What I think is interesting is Galapagos penguins, their safety net are their parents for a longer time than for other penguins. So, for example, on Magellanic penguins in Argentina, when those chicks walk into the sea, they head off for Brazil with nobody. They just got their wits about them, and they're hardwired to jump at anything that moves. And hopefully, they see a fish, and they're able to eat it. What Galapagos penguins are doing, at least for a few weeks, is once the chicks go off and try to find their own food, if they come back to near where the nest was, they're likely to run into the parent. And if they see the parent, they can beg, and sometimes they'll get fed.
Is there a lesson in there for people?
Well, I think you should be careful about your parents. I think they're pretty important.
So maybe these millennial kids who keep boomeranging back, maybe that's good for our species? You know, we complain about them. We laugh about them.
Well, we've got 7.2 billion people in the world, so I don't think we're likely to go extinct. But some of these particularly rare populations, isolated populations, they're on the brink. And so in that sense, I think the more that we can know about what these other critters are facing, the better we're going to do as humans, and they certainly will enrich our life by knowing that they're not so different from humans. I mean, these guys are trying to make a living and raise their kids.
Professor Boersma, I know you care. You make us care. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, Bill.
Dee Boersma is a biology professor at the University of Washington. Wouldn't you like to see a Galapagos penguin begging for food? Answer, yes, you would. You'll agree with me if you go to our website, kuow.org. I'm Bill Radke. Glad you're with us today. Some Washington state counties are on Trump's list. The White House is releasing lists of local jails and the unauthorized immigrants they released before federal officials could deport them. Is this a way to pressure sanctuary cities like Seattle and others? You'll hear that story later this afternoon on KUOW's All Things Considered. Antonio Eas was once a federal immigration agent. Over 25 years, he arrested and helped deport thousands of undocumented immigrants while he worked for the Immigration and Naturalization Service in New York City.
My job was to remove criminal aliens. And what I wanted to do back then was any type of law enforcement action that would get bad people off the street.
Did you love your job?
Oh, I loved it. I loved it. It was the best thing I would do, and it was a passion. It was an energy that I felt being an agent.
Why were you that passionate about deporting people?
Well, I felt that I was doing something the government demanded. The agency existed to safeguard the borders and to safeguard the legal immigration process. So I had a blast doing my job and enforcing the immigration laws.
Antonio Eas has changed his views on immigration a lot. Today, he's Father Antonio of St. Matthew's San Mateo Episcopal Church in Auburn. Here's what changed his mind.
Justice. Justice, if it's calling and it's knocking at your heart, when you believe in justice, there is no tolerance for injustice. And what I strongly believe now is the injustice of the system was the awakening and was the experience in my conversion to see it differently.
Will you tell us one story that illuminates the kind of injustice that opened your eyes?
Yes. Let's take a young person, for example. During one of my enforcement operations, employer operations in New York City, it was a mass operation throughout the city. We hit a local small business that we had information they were hiring undocumented people. And in this operation, it was one of the businesses chosen for action. And we came across this operation. A young lady, a Colombian national, that had been in the United States for several years, was getting educated. She was going to school, going to college. And by virtue of the law enforcement action that day, she was removed. She was out of the U.S. A young person that was living or attempting to live the American dream, no criminal record, no criminal background, her dreams destroyed.
You had busted people like her before. Did you have some conversation with her? What broke through to you that made her not just a number to you?
If you could just see her eyes and you could see the emotion, the intense emotion that the world had just collapsed around her. She's getting deported. Her dreams, not going back home that afternoon. She's going to the detention center. You are seeing a person that it's like a bomb just had gone off and her life, her dreams are destroyed. And just the word, by her just saying a word, help me, can you help me? And there's nothing you can do to help that human being because of the laws at the time.
She asked you for help?
She was asking for help. I want to stay. Can you do something? Because I want to stay. And there's nothing you can do as an agent to change that course of action that she's facing. No discretion at all as an agent.
I can see that stays with you.
It's very hard.
You left immigration enforcement. You are now a priest in Auburn, Padre Antonio. How do you see immigration enforcement now?
I see it worse now than during my days as an agent. When a political campaign started calling for a wall at the border and saying Mexico was sending rapists and criminals across the border. That narrative, I believed then when it was a political campaign, and I strongly believe now, is wrong. And it's getting worse when I see parishioners that are afraid, when I see parishioners that are terrorized by the narrative of the state. You know that things are wrong and dangerous.
This is so interesting, Padre, because you embody both sides of a passionate debate. When you hear people who agree with President Trump's immigration policies or want us to take an aggressive approach to deportations, you did that. Is there a part of you that you can understand that? You can agree with that or at least get where they're coming from? Because that was you.
A nation, a sovereign nation, needs to be a nation of law. So every country has a responsibility to control its borders. But a country needs to be fair to all groups in the immigration process. So I can understand when someone is for immigration enforcement, removing criminal aliens. I understand that. I was there once, and I know that passion. I have lived it. But we need to be just, and we need to be fair with everyone. And that is the deficiency of the system.
Well, Father, I can understand someone saying, yes, our inability to enforce the southern border has left millions of people in this precarious situation. And what's fair and what would keep them from dying in the desert is to put up a border wall and finally enforce that border. I wonder how you feel about the idea of a wall.
I don't believe in walls. I believe in bridges. We, as human beings, we are all human beings after all. So I believe in building bridges and building communication between our neighbor to the south, Mexico.
Again, we're talking with Father Antonio Eyes, who used to be an immigration INS agent. And you, I was very surprised to see before we opened our microphones here, you showed me you still carry your immigration badge in your coat pocket. Why is that?
There is a sense of loyalty and there is a sense of belonging. And this badge and these credentials represent that. It was part of me for so many years. And that's why I still carry them.
How has the meaning of that badge changed to you?
I could see, and it reminds me that although I did a lot for so many years to enforce the laws, I can look back and we have either the same problems, immigration problems, or even worse. It reminds me that, yes, I was a special agent. I very proud of what I was doing. It challenges me that I can do a lot more today as a priest to see in all people God's image and God's creation. So, yes, it's a sense of honor and duty carrying the badge, but a reminder that I can be a lot more effective today as a priest than I was for 25 years as an agent.
Your work's not done.
No.
Padre Antonio Eyes, father at Auburn's St. Matthew San Mateo Episcopal Church. It's been a pleasure talking with you. Thank you.
My pleasure. Thank you so much.
St. Matthew San Mateo became a sanctuary parish in 2007. Father Antonio told me his church will open its doors to any undocumented immigrant who needs a place to stay. Thanks to Andy Hurst of KUOW's immigration team for producing this story, and you'll find more stories at kuow.org. On the topic of immigration, Denver's city attorney says the presence of immigration agents at courthouses has deterred four domestic abuse victims from pursuing cases against their abusers. That's one of the stories you'll hear this afternoon on KUOW's All Things Considered. Good to have you here on KUOW Seattle. I'm Bill Radke. You're about to take a sad bath. And like it, it's also going to get sludgy, so you're warned. From Seattle's Macefield Music Festival in Ballard, DJ Michael Stevens is here with some local bands you ought to know about. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Michael, what's the first band you've got for us?
Well, I have Wild Powers, and Sad Bath is the name of the song that I chose. And full disclosure, these folks are friends of mine, but I wouldn't have chosen this if I didn't love the song.
You do run a music festival. You're bound to become friends with some rockers and musicians.
Exactly, exactly. It's an amazing three-piece, and they're primarily based out of Ballard.
I love the title, Sad Bath.
Yeah, so do I.
I'm not sure what it's about.
I'm not actually sure quite so much what it's about either, but it's the sound of the song itself to me kind of reminds me of taking a sad bath, to be completely honest. Yeah, it has that sort of feeling to it. And this song in particular I like very much because it's much more kind of moody and atmospheric and almost kind of sludgy sounding, almost kind of gothy, dark, atmospheric, but yet they are still very, very rockin'.
Again, that's Wild Powers from Ballard.
Yep.
Right? And the song is Sad Bath.
Yep.
Local DJ Michael Stevens, what's another band you brought for us?
Naked Giants, and this song is Yeah Yeah. Oh my God, the energy, incredible. These kids are going to save rock and roll. And I mean,
yeah, that singer is not a shoegazer. He loves to perform.
Oh my gosh. And then, yeah, I mean, they were just so filled with energy. And that song in particular, what I like so much about it is that I think it can really kind of reach a much wider audience. By that, I mean, there's some pop sensibilities to it for sure, but it still is just, oh my God, it's fantastic. Just super rocking.
Every punky chorus should be, oh, yeah, 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 hey.
Yep, you got a winner.
They put on a live show.
Unbelievable. If you have yet to see, I'm sure you've
seen. I've seen the video.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So if you get to actually go out and check them out, I cannot recommend it enough because they're amazing live and the record's fantastic as well.
That's Naked Giants and Yeah, Yeah. So you like the heavy guitar rock, at least so far.
Yes, I do very much.
Okay, I'm learning that about you.
Yes.
But you've got one more band for us with a very different sound.
Very different sound. So this is Goodbye Heart, Lives on Lives. This is very different from the other two songs that I chose, but still has the kind of, I'm going to keep saying sludgy, but it has that really amazing kind of atmospheric sound. And I described it once as you're on a road trip late at night and no one's around, city seems kind of empty. This is like the perfect soundtrack for that.
Yes. Yeah. I think they even mentioned long drives take lives on lives.
Yep, totally.
Who is Goodbye Heart?
So they're a duo that started out in New York and came out here to Seattle. They're old friends, but I love that they came here from New York to give Seattle a little bit of this kind of wonderful electronic atmospheric music.
I don't know if it's gloomy, pensive.
Pensive, yeah. A little creepy, but I'm not using creepy as a negative term here at all.
Right.
It has a foreboding
that echoey
energy to it. I love that.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's got a Twin Peaks feel to me in the sense of how Twin Peaks, when I watch it, makes me feel.
It's the kind of thing I would have taken along on my way snowboarding.
Totally. And that would be just the best soundtrack as you're going down the mountain. That's fantastic.
Michael Stevens is a local DJ and the co-founder of the Macefield Music Festival in Seattle's Ballard neighborhood. You're listening to KUOW 94.9 Seattle, news and information in Sad Baths. I'm Bill Radke. Good to have you along. How do you respectfully dispose of an old totem pole? It was a gift from Seattle to its sister city in Japan. Correspondent Tom Bonsi has the story from Kobe, Japan.
In 1961, the city of Seattle shipped its new sister city a 35-foot-tall totem crowned by a thunderbird figure, wooden wings spread wide. The painted totem stood in a park next to Kobe City Hall for more than 50 years. But then a few years ago, city workers detected dry rot inside the cedar pole. Mayor Kizo Hisamoto says this was dangerous because it meant the old totem could possibly topple in a storm. Through an interpreter, the mayor explains how the city of 1.5 million people wrestled with how to respectfully retire a rotted totem pole.
We listened to the opinions of many people from Seattle, and we decided to move it and lay it down on the earth in a forest in the northern part of Kobe and return it to the earth as the tradition states.
The totem was cut off at its base and is now laid down in the municipal arboretum. It's still recognizable as a totem pole as it slowly decays. I'm Tom Bonsi in Kobe, Japan.
Thanks for tuning in. I'm Bill Radke. We'll see you tomorrow, noon, KOW's The Record. Friday, KOW's Week in Review.